everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today, but before we begin, I would just like to note that in light of the ongoing vacancy in our court, we are absolutely delighted to have with us today Senior Judge Crawford, and we very much appreciate her willingness to sit with us here today. Our first case today is United States versus Witt. Major Arroyo, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Christie, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Prepared, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Jenna Arroyo, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Andrew Witt. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I would request 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
I'd like to begin today with the message the trial counsel ended with in rebuttal. Members, make no mistake about it, your sentence will send a message. It will send a message about what you as an individual and what you as an airman will accept. It will. It will tell everyone where you draw the line and what you will stand for. It will. Anything less than the death penalty is a message you cannot send. What will you stand for? And that's at JA at 751. These words epitomize the prosecutorial misconduct in this case. This was after, these words come after, the trial counsel had already reiterated 70 times that the member's sentence would tell everyone what they stood for as individuals and as airmen. And it also was accompanied by 8 additional times where he told them they would be personally responsible for the risk of future harm by Senior Airman Witt when he asked, what risk will you accept on someone else's behalf? Now, the Air Force Court found that this was plain and obvious error. However, they erred in their prejudice analysis because they found that Senior Airman Witt was not prejudiced by this severe misconduct. Now, barring any questions from the court, because we believe the resolution of this case actually comes down to prejudice, I will turn to prejudice now.
If I could, there is some flavor in the government's brief that life without parole was a foregone conclusion. Would you like to address that point?
Yes, Your Honor. So in looking at the foregone conclusion argument, there are 3 sentences that were available at this court-martial. So therefore, it's not a foregone conclusion, or we wouldn't have 3 sentencing choices. And when you look at the misconduct here, again, all of the members in voir dire agreed, and that's at JA 420 through 442, that this was a significant punishment, life with the possibility of parole. Again, the other two are also significant punishments. So the fact that this is an option, the fact that there were significant mitigating factors, again, 26 mitigating factors, both in terms of quality and quantity. So not only was there a significant amount in quantity, 26 to 11 aggravating factors, they're also significant in terms of quality. Again, looking at the things that were presented, and I'll get to that in a minute, we don't believe it's a foregone conclusion. So looking at those mitigating factors specifically, the members were instructed that they needed to consider them. Actually, the words are must consider, and that they should consider the following factors, as opposed to may consider aggravating factors. They were told they should consider that he had suffered from a traumatic brain injury 4 months prior to the accident. They were told they should consider his remorse. And he had just demonstrated significant remorse when you look at what has been presented during the sentencing hearing. Again, a sheriff said that during the pretrial hearing that he found him crying after sobbing uncontrollably seeing the crime scene pictures. And again, this sheriff said in his affidavit, I would have been willing to testify. I've seen murderers. I've seen rapists. And I have never been willing to testify except for one other person who I felt demonstrated true remorse. He's demonstrated remorse throughout the 14 years that he was in confinement. Prior to the rehearing, he had no prior history of violence. Again, he had mental health issues in his family's past as well as mental health issues himself. All of those significant mitigating factors make this not a foregone conclusion, Your Honor, because again, presented with those, they could have looked at any of these very significant punishments in deciding that life with the mere possibility of parole actually was a justified punishment under the law.
Counsel, you just said that they could have decided that, but since the issue was forfeited, doesn't appellant have the burden of proving that they would have chosen life with the possibility of parole? Not that they might have, but that they would have.
Your Honor, in looking at this court's case law, the burden on prejudice is whether there was a reasonable possibility that without the trial counsel's misconduct, there would have been a different outcome. And we believe that those mitigating factors show that there was a reasonable probability, but for the fact that the members were hearing repeatedly that what you say in your sentence as an individual and as an airman is going to tell everybody. And if you don't assess the death penalty, then you are a bad person. Now, looking at the death penalty itself, the Air Force found significant that the members had rejected the death penalty. However, in looking at that reasonable probability, we know there are two gates the members had to get through before they could have even assessed the death penalty as an option. The first one is they had to find an aggravating factor unanimously. If they didn't find that, they couldn't even look at the death penalty. And two, we know that they had to find unanimously that any and all mitigating factors were substantially outweighed by aggravating factors. So before, again, unanimously, before they could even gone on. So we actually have no idea, and there is, because of that, those three options, a reasonable possibility they were only looking at two options. And because of those two options they would have been looking at, if they never got through those two gates, there is a reasonable possibility that the trial counsel's significant, severe misconduct, telling them you're a bad person if you don't return this sentence, would have swayed them and tipped the balance so they found life without the possibility of parole. Now, looking at the other Air Force Court's argument, they also said that they found significant that the defense counsel did not make a plea for a recommendation regarding the possibility of parole. And we believe the Air Force Court ignored some of the evidence in the record with regards to the defense counsel's argument. So to start with, when he started his initial argument on page JA-706, he said there are three options that are justified under the law: life with the possibility of parole, life without the possibility of parole, and the death penalty. And then he went on to say on JA-706 that life with the possibility of parole would allow him a second chance at life. And then moving into his argument further in discussing that second gate about the mitigating factors, he said, if you don't find any and all are outweighed by the aggravating factors, the death penalty is not an option. And again, that's at JA-749. And so when you look there, he says that, and then he says, when we consider this, if you don't even have other than those two options, life with the possibility of parole is a question for a different day, for a different authority. And when you do this, when you consider it, it gives him a chance at hope, a chance at redemption, a chance, a second chance that's been missing for the last 14 years. Now, he's been in confinement the last 14 years. There is no difference if he continues to be in confinement without the possibility of parole. So that argument, there is a plea for the life with the possibility of parole. And so in looking at that, those two things that the Air Force Court found significant in their prejudice analysis, we do not believe that those ones are significant when looking at the significant mitigating factors that actually were presented, again, presented with this severe misconduct on behalf of the trial counsel. Again, reiterated from the beginning, reiterated at the end, through the middle, the last thing in rebuttal, those words I started with, that was the last thing that the trial counsel left the members with, is that what will you stand for? Where will you draw the line? You, as an individual and as an airman, what are you telling everyone? What are you telling the families who are watching you right now, deciding what the sentence will be in this case?
Major Arroyo, during the argument, I don't recall the government specifically addressing the lesser two punishments. In other words, life with the possibility of parole or life without. They seem to focus mostly and maybe even entirely on having the members adjudge a death sentence. Is that a correct reading of the government's argument?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a correct reading. And the trial counsel did focus specifically on the death penalty, saying we are asking for a sentence of death.
So nowhere did they say that the accused was not entitled to or deserving of life with the possibility of parole. They never said that's not something you should decide, because they seem to be focused mostly on the actual adjudgment of a death sentence. That's my understanding. Am I correct?
So, Your Honor, can I ask for a clarification? When you say in the government, do you mean the trial counsel at trial, or do you mean the government in their brief?
Oh, I'm sorry, the trial counsel, yes.
Yes, the trial counsel during the trial was focused entirely on the death penalty. So he didn't really address the other two options. However, the military judge specifically instructed, obviously, on those three different options, and the defense counsel addressed all three of them and focused, again, on life versus death because the death penalty would have been an option if those gates had been gone, had been passed. But he did also focus on the possibility of parole as well as life without the possibility of parole.
I understand. Thank you.
And so looking at the prejudice analysis, those two issues that the government, that the Air Force Court found so persuasive, as we've discussed, we do not believe that those are persuasive. And looking at the fact that when we look at those Fletcher factors, the severity of the misconduct here, as I noted, all throughout the argument, it permeated it, as this court has found in some of the other arguments that have been made before it, of Voorhees, those ones, again, permeated it. And there is no less damaging interpretation that this court can make. I mean, when you say this is going to tell where you stand as an individual and as an airman, it's clear that that's what he's telling them. And so there's no less damaging way of interpreting that. The Air Force Court found that that was, just like this court had found in Norwood, a inflammatory hypothetical scenario without any basis in the evidence. And then we look at that second argument where he's talking about you're going to tell the families of it. The Air Force Court found that this specifically placed the weight, both professionally and personally, weight on the members' shoulders of the family's judgment. And they said that that was an inappropriate appeal to the emotions for an improper purpose. Looking at that third error, again, what risk will you accept? The Air Force Court found that that would be something that would have diverted them from their duty to assess inappropriate punishment based on the evidence, and instead made it so they were likely to do it out of fear of being blamed. And so when we look at the severity, it's clearly very severe. Now, looking at the measures that were adopted, really there weren't any. So I know in previous cases there's been questions about the lack of defense counsel objection. We acknowledge that that is also an issue here. However, there are three parties that are present in a trial. There is the defense counsel who has the duty to object, the trial counsel whose duty it is to not inflame the passions of the prejudice of the members, not divert them from their duty, and the judge who has a sua sponte duty to stop the argument and to provide curative instructions. And again, none of that happened here. We have misconduct by the trial counsel. We have the defense counsel not objecting appropriately throughout, and we have the military judge not doing anything to stop it, and no curative measures. Now, looking at the standard instructions, they were only provided at the beginning of the, prior to the arguments. And so that's at JA 258. So you see that he has indicated to them that, again, these arguments are not evidence. But it's not reiterated. And in this court, in United States v. Palacios-Cueto, found that important, that it was reiterated again. Here, it's not reiterated. If you look at JA 259, instead, the judge goes directly into discussing basically the sentencing procedures that they're going to have to follow. So,
counsel, I have a question. This court in the past seems to have found the final Fletcher factor to be, if not dispositive, to carry significant weight. And I find it very hard to do in sentencing, but the final Fletcher factor seems to be essentially, was this an appropriate sentence based on the evidence before the court-martial? And this is, that's a question the CCA answers all the time, right? And in this case, despite having found plain error, they looked at the evidence and they said this was the appropriate sentence, right? Why would we, and we don't do sentence appropriateness, why would we second-guess that analysis from the CCA?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that's because the weight that they place on those two arguments I mentioned prior about the lack of a plea from the defense counsel about the possibility of parole as a recommendation, I believe that they failed to take into account that the defense counsel did, in fact, make a plea. So the weight that they gave there when they were looking at the overall the weight of the evidence, they didn't discuss really the actual plea that happened. They just said, hey, they were only focused on life versus death, and they found that very significant. So because we do not believe they gave appropriate weight to what the argument actually is there, as well as the fact that they've put a lot of weight on the trial counsel's rejection of the death penalty unanimously, which, as I argued just a couple minutes ago, we believe that that's an open question, one that there is a reasonable probability they didn't even get to the death penalty if they found the mitigating factors were not substantially outweighed. And so when we look there, Your Honor, I believe that that is kind of what you should look at in assessing that third factor, again, the weight of the evidence, is that the weight of the evidence and the Air Force Court's focus on it, they didn't really focus on all of this mitigating evidence. They focused really just on the negative, and we are not arguing that these weren't obviously brutal crimes. However, the mitigating evidence was very significant, quantitatively and qualitatively, something that you probably don't see in a lot of these cases, especially the mental health issues, the TBI, all things that they were told they must consider, and they should consider these specific 26. They may consider the aggravating. So there's a difference in the language they were even given. And so when you look at that, that is why we believe, not necessarily second-guessing the Air Force, but giving more appropriate weight to these arguments we have made before you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge, I'm going to ask a question, but it may require counsel to extend their time.
Please.
Thank you for indulging me, sir. I want to go back to this comment you just made about the military judge with a sua sponte duty to kind of jump in here. Can you explain why that would be? I mean, if the defense counsel is sitting there, trial counsel is making these comments, and in this case, a fair number of them, and not objecting, why should the military judge jump in and do the defense counsel's job? How is the judge supposed to know that this is something that should be objected to if defense counsel is not objected? I mean, defense counsel, as far as I know in this case, is 27B qualified, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're assuming that he or she is competent.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, it would have been appropriate for the military judge to interrupt. If the military judge chose not to interrupt anything, especially when these comments are being made that are focusing the members away from the duty to assess the evidence and instead focusing on they themselves, how they were returning a verdict as an individual and as an airman. If he chose not to say that, he could have provided a curative instruction. At the very least, he should have reiterated the standard instructions, which he didn't after 4 hours of argument.
But why do you place the burden on the military judge when defense counsel is sitting there letting the argument continue?
Yes,
I mean, he's already given us permission. You don't have to worry about the clock. But, I guess I'm struggling with this, as you can see, having been a military judge. I'm not letting that bias my opinion, though. Okay. But I guess I'm wondering why that is not a problem for the defense counsel. Either defense counsel is not competent or ineffective. You know what I'm saying? So if the military judge had this duty to jump in during the course of this argument, where does that leave our view of the defense counsel in this case?
Your Honor, we believe the defense counsel should have objected and should have objected a lot. However, I'm not trying to place the burden on the judge. I'm placing the burden on everyone. The way that we see it is the
kind of an equal opportunity blamer, huh?
Yes, Your Honor. All three parties failed in their duties to Senior Airman Witt. The trial counsel, in making the arguments that he made that were inflammatory and appealed to the motions of the members for an improper purpose. The defense counsel for failing to object, and it was not reasonable. Now, looking at whether this was a strategic decision or tactical, it has to be reasonable. It's not reasonable to allow these emotional appeals to the members for an improper purpose and say nothing when Senior Airman Witt's very life hung in the balance. And finally, the judge also, in looking at this and assessing what is going on, had a duty to ensure he had a fair trial. And whether that be by interrupting or not interrupting, instead giving a curative instructions, or at the very least the standard instructions at the end of the arguments, of 4 hours of arguments, all three of these parties failed Senior Airman Witt, which is why we're here today.
I understand. Thank you.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, Mr. Christie.
Chief Judge Olson, and may it please the court, I'm Major Morgan Christie, and along with Colonel Naomi Dennis, I represent the United States. Appellant stabbed an airman and his wife to death in their on-base home and almost killed another airman with that same knife. Despite two premeditated murders and a third attempted premeditated murder, the members returned a unanimous life without parole sentence. this court should affirm that life sentence for two reasons. First, trial counsel's unobjected to arguments were not error, as they were grounded in well-recognized sentencing principles. And second, there's no prejudice when the last thing the panel heard was defense counsel's plea for mercy. And with mercy in mind, they returned a sentence that spared appellant's life. Trial counsel...
Now, you say that the trial counsel's argument was based on sentencing principles. Now, the CCA, and I'm going to quote from them, said the trial counsel, quote, asked the panel members to consider how they would be judged by others by virtue of the sentence they meted out. Now, in the military environment, where you're not facing just social opprobrium, as you would be in the civilian world, but in fact could suffer significant professional repercussions in this highly visible, extremely emotional case, why wasn't that argument so extraordinarily toxic as to render this whole proceeding essentially one that was inappropriate?
Because, Your Honor, when trial counsel began his argument, he urged the members to turn inward when he said, ask yourselves what you will stand for. And behind him...
Okay, but then you're cherry-picking. This counsel went on forever. He was extraordinarily repetitive. And the characterization by the CCA here could be argued to be a correct one, where at times trial counsel was saying that when you make this decision, panel members, you will be judged by others. That's the question I have.
Well, that's certainly the most sinister interpretation, Your Honor. But the Supreme Court has long held since Donnelly that this court should not lightly infer the members would draw the most damaging meaning when there are other reasonable alternative meanings. And here there were. Not only was trial counsel using his words, but behind him were 256 PowerPoint slides that methodically marched through all the evidence in this case. And defense counsel didn't object before, during, or after on the grounds he now asserts on appeal, despite more than 70 opportunities to do so. With the backdrop of those slides, trial counsel's themes didn't divert the members' focus away from the evidence. Rather, he repeated those themes as he went through the evidence. For instance, the very first time trial counsel asked the members, what do you stand for? Where do you draw the line? He immediately said these crimes occurred on base, in base housing, where military members are supposed to feel safe. Behind him were photos of that on-base family
but
home.
How does that tie into, what sentencing principles are you looking at? What are you tying that into in terms of sentencing principles?
For that one, Your Honor, that goes to the preservation of good order and discipline. When trial counsel argued this happened in uniform on base to one of our own, and then behind him are photos of that on-base family home turned crime scene where appellant butchered three military victims with an 11.5-inch hunting knife, in context, that argument is tethered to the evidence and grounded in the preservation of good order and discipline. And defense counsel never objected on the grounds that this was an inflammatory argument. So clearly he didn't perceive this argument as damaging to his client.
We've got a heinous crime, right? You spent 15 pages of your brief describing it and the fallout from it, right? So you certainly believe you've got an egregious crime here. Why is the trial counsel at sentencing talking about the panel at all and the members, right? We have two premeditated murders and an attempted murder, right? You keep referencing how horrendous these crimes were, right? You want to keep reminding us of that. What is the purpose of directly addressing the panel members at all? What possible justification is there for asking the panel members these kinds of questions that they were asked over and over and over again?
The purpose, Your Honor, is that death is different. The death penalty is uniquely individual and unique in its severity and irrevocability. The government bears special burdens of proof in capital sentencing, and it's different in how the members vote, too. If they sentenced appellant to death, each member would personally sign their name to the sentencing worksheet. And the members unanimously affirmed in voir dire that voting for death was their individual decision, so it's entirely fitting to address them individually. Trial counsel's rhetorical and reflexive questions were designed to have the members make an individual moral decision whether appellant lived or died. After all, the military judge instructed them it was a grave responsibility, so it's not wrong to impress upon them the seriousness of their moral verdict. Trial counsel asked the members to assert their own internal influence, not exert external influence. The death penalty is an individual and internal struggle and perhaps the most permanent demarcation line. It's not error, no less plain error, to use these idioms to help frame the member's decision as setting a line, as translating individual values into a sentence. And for that reason, this case is not Norwood. The trial counsel in Norwood made the members...
Can I just ask you, though, in response to that question, you're saying death is different, and so it was permitted here. Are you saying that in those cases where there would be a lesser punishment, maximum punishment, that it would be improper for trial counsel to make these arguments?
Certainly not, Your Honor. It just goes...
So what's the point you're making when you're saying death is different?
The point I'm making, Your Honor, is that trial counsel unapologetically was arguing for death, which would have required a unanimous decision and in the individuals ascribing their names and their ranks to that sentencing worksheet. So because of the unanimity requirement that is only available in capital cases, that does make it different insofar as trial counsel can properly tell the members that their job is to make an individual decision. Defense counsel even recognized this in his argument and through voir dire when he made sure that every member understood that this is personal and individual and their own internal struggle and debate and is theirs and theirs alone to make.
But still, I still don't hear any justification for talking about how the members are going to be perceived, right? We've got tons of evidence. You've got all of the evidence of the harm that was caused. What is the point of addressing the panel? Why is the trial counsel not talking about the evidence and what happened and the terrible crimes that were committed? I still don't hear any justification for addressing these rhetorical questions you called to the panel members.
Well, Your Honor, trial counsel did have 256 slides that did depict all the evidence that was admitted in this case. But it's entirely proper to ask the members if this is acceptable conduct in the military community, because a severe sentence may better assist in maintaining good order and discipline than a lenient sentence. And to that end, trial counsel argued on base in uniform to one of our own, which were the facts of the case. And trial counsel is charged with being a zealous advocate for the government. That includes being emphatic, forceful, and blunt in addressing sentencing objectives. The Missouri Supreme Court permitted many of trial counsel's arguments in Weaver as fair inference from the evidence. And the Eastern District of Ohio in Bryan permitted these arguments as the creative latitude that's afforded to counsel.
But all these things you're citing go to the very point that Judge Hardy is making. What you're describing now about permitted argument has nothing to do with the point that Judge Hardy is raising about why is it the focus on panel members decide this based on how you will be judged by others.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, that's not what trial counsel said. That's certainly the most damaging interpretation to say you will be judged by others. But even the inflection that appellate defense counsel uses in oral argument is not the same demeanor, tone, and inflection that was used at trial. Defense counsel certainly didn't perceive those arguments that way and was in the best position in real time to perceive how the members reacted, and he didn't think the remarks were inflammatory. When members are given a range of sentencing options, they personally are inevitably being asked to draw a line in deciding where on the sentencing spectrum this case falls. That's exactly what they were supposed to do. And if defense counsel was truly concerned that trial counsel's comments were blatantly coercing the members into a harsher sentence, he would not have tactically acquiesced. Defense counsel shouldn't be allowed to sit through 70-plus possible objections, making no attempt to cure the alleged error, and then
claim
on a...
I don't even think appellant's counsel is contesting that we're in a plain error situation here, right? So it's been forfeited. We'll just assume that. And then going forward, was there plain error here or not?
Yes, Your Honor. And there is no plain error because even if this court finds error, it's not obvious or clear under current law. The parameters for permissibly arguing these themes are too unchartered in military courts and too nuanced in federal courts to find plain error. And as this court held in Akbar and recently affirmed in Bench, the absence of controlling binding precedent strongly undermines plain error.
Is UCI not a thing anymore?
It certainly is, Your Honor.
So that specter is out there, and as the Chief alluded to earlier, it's questionable whether any of these arguments might be permissible in an Article III court, but here we're in the military justice system where all of those panel members are thinking about promotions and assignments and their career. Why is the trial counsel addressing these questions to them with the specter of UCI looming over this entire proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, first, appellant has not alleged that trial counsel injected command into the deliberation room. And while a trial counsel unapologetically argued for death, he didn't warn of speculative community scorn that would ensue like Norwood. He didn't scold or scourge the members like trial counsel did in Wood. He never admonished them that they wouldn't be doing their job if they voted for life like trial counsel did in Young. So I think
But you said before that the CCA's characterization was the most sinister. So let's look at specific statements directly out of the mouth of the trial counsel. Quote, from E6 to O6, where else in your career will you have the opportunity to draw the line as an individual and as an airman on what you will allow? How does that tie into what Judge Hardy's talking about in terms of you really venturing into the territory of unlawful command influence when it comes to issues such as promotions and assignments, when in this highly visible, extraordinarily emotional, unbelievably gruesome, atrocious offense, that there is this tying into sending a message about where you stand as an airman. And then the other quote, members, make no mistake about it, your sentence will send a message. That's perfectly appropriate. Sentences should send a message about what society would accept and about the heinousness of an offense. It says it will send a message about what you as an individual, what you as an airman will accept. It will tell everyone where you draw the line and where you will stand for. It will. Why isn't that extraordinarily toxic in a military environment?
Because, Your Honor, another more reasonable interpretation is that trial counsel was saying, where else will you have the opportunity to set the standard for good order and discipline in the military, which necessarily relies on the member's rank and experience? And so opportunity in this context could be interpreted as you have the ability to advance your careers by adjudging death, which there's no support for that in the record. Or opportunity could mean the chance to participate in the judicial process as an important civic responsibility. Presumably, this is the only time in the members' lives and careers they will sit on a capital case. So it's not error to remind them of that uniquely grave responsibility, especially when we're under a plain error standard. And even if this court finds plain error, appellant cannot show material prejudice. Defense counsel exclusively argued for the death penalty, yet despite his best efforts, the members unanimously returned a life sentence. Both the Air Force Court in Wilson and the 11th Circuit in Parker v. Allen, both capital cases, found any error harmless when the panel rejected the death penalty in favor of a life sentence. And that approach makes even more sense in this case when the decision was unanimous, even though it was not unanimous in Wilson and Parker. And while it's normally difficult to calibrate the effect of sentencing error, the sentence returned is a solid indication, especially with premeditated murder. The sentencing options are limited because there's a mandatory minimum of life. So this case doesn't pose the same concerns that this court recently struggled with in Edwards, an unpremeditated murder case. There's no broad spectrum of lawful punishments the panel might adjudge. And the singular focus of the defense's case at trial was sparing appellant's life. In opening, defense counsel did not mention parole because he recognized this is not a case that warrants parole. The whole thrust of the defense calling their prison risk expert was to testify to risk for a person in prison. They argued appellant can live in jail without incident. In fact, defense counsel directly pleaded to the members, why do we have to kill him? Why can't he live in this prison population? Defense counsel told the members this case is only about whether he should live or die. So the members were given a binary sentencing choice by the defense, and they went with exactly what the defense asked for. So any error is harmless under the three Fletcher factors. First, defense counsel's lack of objection is some measure of that minimal impact. Defense counsel strategically chose not to object more than 70 times. Instead, he co-opted the theme for his own benefit and deflated trial counsel's argument succinctly. The law has already defined the line in the sand. The law has already taken a stand when he was convicted 14 years ago. Obviously, that strategy worked because the members aligned their sentence with what defense asked for. Defense counsel also had the last word in surrebuttal. The opportunity to rebut improper arguments is a curative measure. An appellant argues that trial counsel had the last word and the members were left to ponder these instances of misconduct, but the members deliberated for 8 hours with a recess overnight, and the last argument they heard before beginning deliberations was defense counsel's surrebuttal. And finally, the third Fletcher factor so heavily weighs in the government's favor that this court can decide on that ground. During argument, trial counsel played the 911 call. That 30-second 911 call had more of an impact than trial counsel's two-hour argument. The members heard the husband's reaction to his wife being stabbed to death in front of him as he lay paralyzed, helpless to save her. Trial counsel's words did not inflame the members' passions. The evidence did. There's no miscarriage of justice in this case if this court declines to invoke plain error, because trial counsel's comments ultimately were bland and pale in comparison to the evidence that was presented. And pending any other questions, Your Honor.
I have a question. So in applying the Fletcher factors, the CCA basically gets to the third factor, and it essentially agrees with the argument you just made, and in the end, they even say, well, we believe the sentence was appropriate. The way that test plays out, as it played out in this case and has played out in the past at this court, it seems like it just sort of says, well, no matter what error happened during sentencing, as long as the CCA got the answer right, or the court-martial, the panel got the answer right, and judged an appropriate sentence, then none of it really matters. Is that really, maybe you disagree with that characterization of how the Fletcher test plays out, but is that really the right way to approach sentencing errors? I mean, does that really give us confidence that the sentence was on the basis of the evidence alone and not influenced by the error?
Your Honor, certainly every case stands on its own facts, and this court and the CCA must look to what actually happened in each case. So it should not be used as a carte blanche, we can just always skirt the issue of error. If that were also the case, then the field wouldn't get guidance all the time on what the parameters are of improper argument, and certainly improper argument is developed through case law, since there's nothing in the manual that speaks to the contents. But I do think what's important is the CCA also looked to whether evaluated this error against the entire record. And the Supreme Court in Young advised to evaluate error against the entire record. And here, although the error, if this court finds error, did happen more than one time in the closing argument, it's confined to the argument and on the 16th day of trial.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Christie, Major Arroyo.
Thank you.
Judge Sparks, I want to address your question really briefly about my comment about the judges. And so in Voorhees,
I wasn't taking it personally, you know.
That's fine. I'm just addressing it to you, everyone on the court, as well as Judge Sparks. With regards to the sua sponte duty, so in Voorhees, this court did say that judges are not mere figureheads or umpires, and it's their sua sponte duty to ensure a fair trial. And so I think that is what I was trying to get at when I said, looking at this instruction, curative instruction, stopping the argument, that he's not a mere figurehead or an umpire, but he did have that duty to ensure the fair trial.
I understand.
And looking, Judge Hardy, at your question about the CCA and when they assess prejudice, I think it's very important to realize that we don't know what happened in that deliberation room. We don't know if they got through the first gate and decided that there was an aggravating factor unanimously. We don't know if they got through the second gate and determined that the mitigating factors were substantially outweighed by those aggravating circumstances. So since we don't know, the trial counsel could have been so prejudiced, or the members could have been so prejudiced by trial counsel's severe misconduct reiterated throughout his entire argument that they unanimously voted for the worst punishment they were able to give once death was not on the table. And Chief Judge Olson, you mentioned a question about the analogous, I guess, to Norwood, and I know that counsel was addressing that. I do believe it's directly analogous to Norwood, because when you look at what was being told to the members, they were being told that this, that the members, that the families, that everyone was going to see their sentence. So when he said to them, this is going to show what you think individually and as an airman, they were aware in this, again, highly publicized, intensely scrutinized, capital proceeding, that their sentence was going to tell people what they thought themselves, internalized morality, what they were actually willing to stand for, where they would draw the line. Again, not an appropriate sentencing procedure. Looking at what happened in this case, this was a very brutal crime, and no one is contesting that. But there didn't need to be a theme about what people stood for as individuals and what they stood for as airmen. Instead, the backdrop and the focus should have been on the actual crimes. The members should have come back with a sentence that actually addressed those crimes and not what they stood for as individuals, not what they stood for as airmen, not because they were worried about being blamed because Senior Airman Witt might commit future misconduct. And because of that, he was prejudiced by these comments. Barring any
further. Any questions from my colleagues? The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. This court will stand in recess until 10:40.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:40.